from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Missouri Senator Lincoln Huff has had a very, very eventful 2025. Not only did he lose his post as the chairman of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee, but he also gained a lot of attention when he refused to go along with cutting off Democratic filibusters through a maneuver known as the previous question. The Springfield Republican joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking for a candid assessment of the Missouri Republican Party in 2025. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oral talk over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from beautiful mid-Missouri, she covers all things state government, state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us from scenic and bustling Springfield, Missouri, he represents Missouri's 30th senatorial district.
Lincoln Huff. Actually, Jason, the first correction of the podcast will be that I'm actually doing this interview from the farm out in Fairgrove. So way to go for rural Missouri.
Well, I'm glad that you could correct me on a rare
such an important detail, right?
Well, I'm a big geography buff, as you'll see in throughout this interview.
Yep.
I want to just ask a basic question. What has this calendar year been like for you in this wacky world of Missouri politics?
Well, I think that's probably the best description that anyone could come up with, Jason, this wacky world of Republican Missouri politics, maybe politics in general. Look, there's always something going on, right? Like we lived through, the COVID pandemic when we took a 5-week spring break that year from the legislature, you know, not knowing kind of what the environment was like to come back. I mean, the last year has been, in my opinion, it's been kind of topsy-turvy. And it's unfortunate because I think a lot of the changes, at least, you know, I'll speak from the Senate perspective, a lot of the changes that have happened in the Senate, I think, are detrimental to what the institution is supposed to be. And it's kind of funny, like I'm 43 years old, and somehow, somewhere, Jason, Sarah, along the way, I became the old guy in the chamber, even though Mike Searpoy, you know, I think he turned 89 or 102 last year. But I seem to be like this resident historian all of a sudden. And it's because, you know, when I started in the House back in 2011, there were still guys like Ron Richard over in the Senate. Wasson was over there. Mike Cunningham, who I did get to serve with a couple of years in the Senate. But those guys actually served with the folks that were there before term limits. Okay. Like that's how fast time has progressed with politics in Missouri. And I think what you've seen in the last year, specific to cutting off debate, and I'm sure we'll get into this, Jason, but not even having a discussion about the two issues that we had the last extraordinary session for. I mean, you understand that, and Brad Hudson's a nice guy. He's now the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And I think whenever he was given that post, he, you know, put something out that said, you know, we're going to scrutinize every dollar. Having been the guy who's been running that committee for the last 3 years and been on the committee the entire time, I was the vice chair for the first 4 years I was in the Senate. I guess I would say good luck, Brad, because it's $50 billion. And the idea that you're going to scrutinize every single dollar or every penny that I don't remember exactly what he said. It may make for a good soundbite, but it's not practical. And so I look forward to what this next session is going to hold.
It seemed from the outside looking in that the Senate was actually functioning much better this past general session up until the last week, and really just before the last week. And that's when the House ended up torpedoing a capital improvements bill. And then the Senate used what's known as the previous question, or basically for our listeners, a way to end debate, which does not happen in the Senate typically, on measures targeting voter-approved abortion and paid sick leave measures. So what do you think caused this shift in vibes, so to speak?
I think when people stop negotiating, when people stop talking, that's when things break down. The Senate has always been that cooling saucer of the overflow of the coffee cup, right? That is the House. I mean, I don't know if Jefferson said that, but this new shift, this new structure, if you want to call it, you can say that it functions better. I'm not sure that the outcomes are better. When Caleb Browden was the pro tem or Dave Schatz was the pro tem, I mean, we would have heated arguments in their offices, my office, the minority leader's office. And I guess the thing that I think that's changed, Sarah, we kept talking. We were always negotiating. It wasn't, well, too bad. There's more of us than there are of you. And that's something that I'll give Caleb a lot of credit. We used to talk to JJ all the time, Rizzo from Kansas City, and we'd say, look, like ultimately we're going to get where we want to be, but let's do it in a professional and respectful way. And I think, like I said, I think when you start just ending debate and saying, I'm done even talking about it, I think you've got a problem. I think it's a breakdown in democracy. I don't think specific to the Senate, I don't think that's what the Senate's supposed to be.
And if I'm not mistaken, you ended up voting against all of the previous question motions.
Absolutely. Yeah,
How come?
absolutely.
Why?
Well, because I think it's wrong. Because I think I do not believe that we were at an impasse on any of that legislation to the point where that negotiations had actually ceased, other than just one side just walking away and saying, well, forget it, we'll just and I always say PQ, right? We'll just PQ the thing and move on. And specific to the last extraordinary session, and I sort of alluded to this earlier, Sarah, we didn't even talk about the legislation. Okay? PQ motions were signed the day before we ever went to the floor. It wasn't like we'd been negotiating for 72 hours, 96 hours straight, and heads were just butting against each other and no one was getting anywhere, and the majority party threw its hands up and said, never mind, I guess we don't have any choice. My point is, we never even talked about it. And I think that's wrong.
Do you think the fact that PQs were used so much marks a shift of how the Senate operates, and what do you think that means for the legislative process going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary scenario in my opinion, and it's indicative of a lot of new folks coming over from the House primarily, who I believe are just used to that being the order of business. And again, the reason I started off with the perspective of the senators that I mentioned previously, like Ron Richard and Jay Wasson, those guys, they had a different idea about what the Senate was. And look, and I understand, Sarah, I understand, Jason, that things change, right? Politics change and paradigms shift and priorities change. But the core values of what the institution of our Missouri Senate is something that, and I'm probably overstating this, but like it's almost, sacred to me because it's worked the whole time Missouri's been here. And if we start unraveling it now, my fear is that what you've really done is you've turned the Senate into a smaller version of the House of Representatives, where if you have the floor leader and the pro tem who say, we're going to do this, and you have, 18 members who say, yep, nope, we're with you, then you don't have to negotiate. And I don't think that that's the way democracy is supposed to work.
And we'll talk about the other part of the second special session, the measure that would substantially restrict initiative petitions for constitutional amendments later in the show. But I want to talk about the redistricting plan. You ended up voting against it along with Senator Mike Moon. Why did you end up voting against it?
Well, I mean, again, the fact that we were handed. And you got to remember, like, a redistricting bill is a piece of legislation, right? So it should, in my opinion, go through a process. And I've been, Jason, through two redistricting processes while I've been elected. The 2010 and the 2020 census. And they are hard, right? Like, it's a meat grinder of a session every time we have to go through redistricting. But you know what happens? People get together and people negotiate and people talk. And we've never in my tenure, right, of almost 14 years now, we've never just been handed a map and said, here it is. Don't touch it. Don't even talk about it. Just pass it. I mean, we can get into like what I actually believe is right and wrong about an 8-1 map or a 7-1 map or a 6-2 map. But I think when you carve Kansas City up, and I'm not so sure that my shack apartment in Jeff City isn't in that new congressional district now, that runs all the way over to downtown Kansas City.
It could be.
It
I'm not
might
100%
be.
sure.
I mean, like there's a portion of Cole County that's in that district now. I mean, I think if you showed that map to a bunch of fourth graders, right, who are studying, Missouri politics and state government, I think they'd look at that and say, who in the world drew this?
Well, as we're recording this, opponents of the new map are turning in roughly 300,000 signatures to put the plan up for referendum. I'm just going to ask you, do you think your colleagues knew this map could be referendumed?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about a lot of these issues, when you talk about abortion, yeah, I mean, the map is IP reform, all of it. I mean, you know who wins on these things, right? Chuck Hatfield and Mark Ellinger.
I was going to say,
Like they're
Chuck
just
Hatfield,
like I
yeah.
mean, I assume they're just like they're digging bigger pools in their backyards, or they're like, I don't know, they're getting like the another Mercedes. Like I mean, like I don't even know how how you don't see that. No, all this stuff gets challenged. And those are the team. Mark's on our side and Chuck's on the other side. And I mean, they're probably in court today or yesterday or whatever.
Well, I asked because I realized at the beginning of the second week that there were not enough votes in the House to make the map go into effect right away. And there were not going to be enough votes in the Senate either because you and Mike Moon were not going to vote for this and you weren't going to vote for the emergency clause. I just wonder if like the Trump people knew this, because if they knew that this could be put up for a referendum, maybe they would have gone to a different state rather than this becoming basically a money sinkhole.
I don't think that that's ever a consideration. I'll just be honest with you. I think that these people, I mean, the folks in DC, I think they're so hyper focused on doing whatever the thing is that they want to do right now that almost, ramifications be damned. We're not worried about where this thing's going to go in the next 6 months, 8 months, year, whether it gets tossed out. I mean, my fear is, well, if a court says this map is unconstitutional, I mean, who's to say that, well, what we really need to do, Jason, is start replacing judges until we get the verdicts we want, don't you
Yeah,
think?
and that's another
Right?
possibility. Yeah, there's another possibility that like this entire referendum thing could be moot if the Missouri Supreme Court says you can't do mid-decade redistricting.
Right.
I won't even get into the whole fact that the proponents are using the Airbud rule to defend it, because I feel like we've played that out.
And
But
yet you said it on the
I did.
podcast.
I did it, but you can go in our archives and know what I'm talking about. I think a broader question is, what do you think of Attorney General Hanaway and Secretary of State Hoskins' effort to derail the referendum? And like, I understand there's a lot of pressure for them to act, but a lot of people are really upset that Republican officials are being so blatantly hostile, either toward initiative petitions or the referendum efforts. Like, what do you make of the fact that they're trying to prevent this referendum from going to voters?
I think it's a sad state of where politics, and it's not just Missouri, guys, let's be honest. Like it's all over the country, but how far this has devolved into partisan idealism over actual governing, right? I mean, I don't know. Jason, we'd have to go back and start counting, and we'd probably need, more fingers and toes than we have to look at the things that have been put up to a referendum post the legislature passing them in my, like I said, almost 14 years in and out of the building, because it just seems like it happens over and over. And even if you mentioned paid sick leave and And that was voter approved. And it's always been just wildly hypocritical to work in that environment where my colleagues say the voters are smart enough to vote for me to send me to the Senate. But what I'll tell you what they're not smart enough to do is figure out the nuance of this ballot initiative or that ballot initiative. And I probably could have gotten in a place where an IP reform bill, initiative petition reform bill that tightened that up a little bit. I probably could have voted for something like that, but I can't vote for things when we just don't, like I said, we don't even talk about them. We don't even bring them to the floor. We just say, here's the plan and this is what we're doing. And the plan came from somewhere else.
Moving on to the budget, you were removed from your post as Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman soon after the second special session ended. What was your reaction when that occurred?
Well, you want me to joke, Sarah, and say relief that now I don't have to worry about, the $50 billion and the 800,000
I
meetings that I
do
have.
imagine that your session's going to be a little more smoother
I mean,
compared to
there's a
last
reason.
year.
Yeah, there's a reason I'm out on my farm right now, and I've got a horse saddled in the backyard, and I'm going to go check some cows whenever I get off the phone with you. But it's again, it's disappointing, Sarah. That's what it is. It's disappointing that this Republican Party is not the Republican Party that I started with. Probably 16, 17, 18 years ago. I mean, when I first got into politics, and we're going to end up having this whole, and I'll tell this whole story during some long, boring conversation on the Senate floor. But the thing that got me into politics was when I was living in Greene County in Springfield, and our Greene County Commission, I'll give you the very short version of the story. More or less, the Greene County Commission decided they were going to come up with something they called a land use plan. They were going to draw lines on a map of the county and say, we're going to foster and promote development in these areas and not in these other areas. And we're going to call those agricultural reserves. And what that did, in my opinion, was that just took the developmental potential of a whole lot of unincorporated Greene County away from the property owners that were sitting there that had owned that property maybe sometimes for generations. So it's a sad state that the Republican Party now is a party about conformity more than our, in my belief, our true core ideals as a party. I mean, now you're expected to get in line, don't ask any questions, don't even talk about it, just do what you're told. And that's not what I got elected to do. And I don't think, the 170,000 people in Springfield want me to go up to Jeff City just to be told how to do something and when to vote. I don't work for Washington, D.C., right? I don't work for the governor. I work for the city of Springfield and I work for the people of Missouri.
Do you think you were ousted because you voted against the two items in the September special session, the new congressional map and the ballot item, making it much harder to pass constitutional amendments?
I think that's part of it, but I think the bigger, if you want my real opinion, I think the bigger issue was my committee unanimously voted out a budget this last year that added $300 million to the K-12 foundation formula against the recommendation of the administration. And subsequently, I found out from our pro tem that she believed most of the members on our appropriations committee that are Republicans didn't want to do that. To which my rebuttal is, well, that's interesting because they all voted for it. And I think her response was something like, that's because I told them to, which goes back to my original point. If you're just doing what you're told, you're not doing anything.
Senate President Pro Tem O'Loughlin put out a statement saying that she replaced you with Senator Rusty Black of Chillicothe, basically because you were terming out of office, and added, quote, "It is vital co to ensure continuity and stability in this critical role." What is your response to that?
If you're buying that, I've got some oceanfront property in Fairgrove, I'll sell you. That
Do you
is, I mean, that's a joke. And like anyone in Jefferson City, and this is something that I always say, there are no secrets in Jeff City. If this was her plan all along, everyone in the Capitol and within, 2.5 miles of the building would have known after our regular session that this was her plan. This, I don't buy that for a second. And if we're going to foster continuity in this important role, do you think maybe I would have talked to the new chairman any time in the last, I haven't talked to Rusty Black since the last special session. He wasn't at our at our fall caucus meeting down in Branson. I figured we'd get to catch up then and start talking through things. We always do a budget presentation. Our budget director, Adam Koningsfeld, and our deputy director, Dana Wanzing, always come and kind of give a high points of what to expect and here's how things work. And they answer questions. And our chairman, our new chairman, wasn't there. So if we're fostering continuity in this quote important role, I would have thought I would have had some communication from the new chairman, but that hasn't been the fact that hasn't happened.
You mentioned spending priorities with the budget. Do you think there might be other reasons as to why you were ousted, depending on spending priorities? For instance, you were opposed to efforts to not fund Medicaid expansion after voters approved it in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, voters, again, that goes back to what Jason was mentioning earlier. So voters approved something. I actually put a plan forward, a very conservative model, when I was the vice chair, and Senator Dan Hageman was the chair of the Appropriations Committee. Put a very conservative estimate together to go ahead and fund that expanded, constitutionally approved expanded population. And the committee, in a unique situation, voted 7-7. So the motion fails, right? A tie fails. So we did not ultimately fund that population until, oddly enough, later on in the summer. It was either July or August, somebody else knows the exact date, when the Missouri Supreme Court unanimously handed down a verdict saying you have to pay for that population's expanded coverage in Medicaid. You have to. Unanimously said you have to. And I remember I was actually fishing with some buddies, and Senator Hageman, who was still the chair at the time, called me up. And I mean, he said, "Well, I guess you were right." And I said, "Dan, it's not about being right." Excuse me. I said, "It's not about being right. It's about doing what's right." And that's what we're missing right now.
Speaking again on the budget, there's some expectations in the upcoming budget process will be difficult, perhaps because of the legislature eliminating the capital gains tax. Do you expect major cuts to be necessary to the budget?
So here's another unique thing, Sarah. Like I said, I hate being the constant historian here, but myself, Senator Searpoy, Senator Bernsketter, Senator Crawford, that might be about all of us. We're the only members, not just in the Senate, but in the House also, who served the last time we had to actually cut general revenue from the budget. Okay, I was a freshman member of the House Budget Committee. Back then, there weren't, 212 members of the House Budget Committee. There were like 35 of us or something. And so it was kind of a big deal to get a freshman spot on there. And I remember our speaker at the time said, "I don't know why you want to do this." He said, "It's a bad budget year. Next year doesn't look a whole lot better. It looks maybe flat, but it's going to be tough." And it's that old line that if you're not sitting at the table, you're on the menu, right? I believe that the people that I represent would appreciate their elected folks being at the table when those decisions are being made. Yeah, I think next year is going to be tough. Now, I don't think it's as tough as our budget and planning director Dan Hogg wants to make it sound. September numbers were good. November numbers were good. We have, I think, roughly, I looked yesterday, Sarah, I think we have roughly four, a little over $4 billion still in the bank. And you got to remember, I come from those days when Jay Nixon was the governor. And if we carried over three, four, $500 million from one fiscal year to the next, we thought we were doing great. And now we have $4+ billion in the bank. And I know the argument. The argument is, well, all that money's spent. Like you're talking to the guy who put the plan together to rebuild I-70, which I always kind of caveat that with, sorry about the construction right now, but you're going to love it in like 3 or 4 years, I promise. Right? When that thing is three lanes, both directions, all the way across the state, it's going to be a game changer for not just mid-Missouri, but for the Midwest and for not just our travelers, but our truckers and everybody else. Yes, those bills are hanging out there, but it's kind of like buying a house. When you buy a house, do you have all the money in your checking account for the house and all the bills come due at once? Or do you, most of us, have a mortgage and pay for it over however many years, right? With income that you bring in from your job. We have 1.5 million taxpaying entities in this state that pay into 800 different checking accounts every single day. So the idea that we're broke now, I don't buy. Now, if you want to talk about how do you become broke real quick, let's eliminate the income tax and not come up with a sustainable solution to replace the $9 billion that the individual income tax in this state brings in. Okay. Capital gains tax, you can talk about that if you want, but like that number is probably, somewhere, I would say double, if not triple, the fiscal note, which was a little over $100 million. So I'm going to say that, it's probably not the high watermark of 650, but it's probably somewhere in between, like 350 to 400 million, which, yeah, I mean, like, that's a lot of money, but that's not 9 billion. So I am anxious to see what the plan is from the administration. And I think we got an announcement yesterday that he's going to do the state of the state a little earlier than normal. Although I also think didn't it say that we're not going to talk specifics on the budget. So I guess we'll roll that out, or he'll roll that out a little later. But replacing $9 billion in the state is not an easy thing.
And we'll be right back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Lincoln Hough. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Lincoln Hough. He is a Republican from Greene County. There is some expectations that the 2026 session is going to be very nasty and unproductive for all the reasons we mentioned, but one of the things we have not mentioned is Democrats in the Senate especially have said that they might hold up business for long stretches of time because of all these previous questions. What do you expect to happen over the next few months
So,
based off
Jason,
that backdrop?
you and I have been doing this long enough to know that pretty much every time, every this time of year, every December, November, post Thanksgiving, before Christmas, we start having these conversations like, well, what's next year going to look like? What's it going to look like? And the thing that I guess for your listeners and your viewers, if they end up watching some of this, you never know. You just never know. I mean, I wasn't there for the 17 months of the Greitens administration. I was a county commissioner for Greene County for that 2 year stretch before I went back up to the Senate. But it's always something. Now, I think the dynamic has changed considerably given the way our regular session ended and the railroading of the special sessions? Absolutely. Do I think that there's significant lost trust between members? Probably more so than there's ever been. And I mean, like, you know, when I and I don't talk to him all the time, but when I do talk to the minority leader, the conversation is like, who do you make a deal with? Who can you look in the eye and say, I will do this if you do this, and we'll all adhere to what we're saying right now? Because it just seems like over and over, you go in and you try to negotiate something, and then someone moves the goalpost, or someone just doesn't do what they said they were going to do. And at some point, it's like, fool me once, fool me twice, right? Like, you can't keep fooling people. So I think there's a huge level of distrust. I always look, I raise cattle, right? I am the eternal optimist. I hope that we get some summertime rains. I hope that we've got enough hay to get through the winter. I hope, the calves grow, all that kind of stuff. So I hope that this is a good year. But I think the level of distrust right now among my colleagues is significant. And I think we've got some growing to do with the new freshman senators that have come in. And I think, I wish we had a few more of those, kind of old timers around to say, hang on, let's take a break. And I've told this story several times, Jason, but and I don't even remember what the rule change was, but Dave Schatz, when he first became the pro tem, he wanted to change some, I think, a fairly inconsequential, I'm sure, rule on how the chamber functioned. And there's, Doug Leibla and Gary Romine. Okay, those guys are sitting on opposite ends in the back row of the Senate, and this is a Thursday, right? I come over from the House. I'm a freshman senator, but I've spent 6 years in the House. On Thursdays, Jason, what do? We do things as fast as we can so we can get the hell out of town. Like, everybody wants to go home. And the point of the story is Gary and Doug got up and talked for 7 hours on a Thursday afternoon until Dave Schatz said, okay, never mind, we're not going to change this rule. And I went over to him later and I was like, guys, what in the hell was that about? And they said, we don't change the rules in the Senate like this. We don't do that. The Senate works, and it works for a reason. So my fear is we've lost that with a number of the new folks who just are apparently okay with ceding their power with leadership.
Are there any issues that you think could be at the forefront of debate that could actually garner bipartisan support this upcoming session?
I don't know what they would be.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I honestly don't know. I mean, like, look, I'm, like I said, the eternal optimist here. Like, I believe that the vast majority of people in elected office got into it because they care about their communities, they care about their schools, and they care about their businesses, and they care about, the people who don't have maybe as much as everybody else, right? But I don't know, like, we're so divided right now, Sarah. I mean, I spent, you got to remember, I spent a year running for lieutenant governor all over the state, and my whole message was, we don't have to be this apart. We don't have to be this divided. We can actually find some common ground. And there's always issues that we're not going to see eye to eye on. Like, I get that, and I understand that. But there should be, and I still remain hopeful that there are those issues that we can come together on. Now, right now, sitting here, on my farm, I'm not sure what they are. Moving forward, I mean, if Rusty is really tasked with cutting $1 billion out of the budget, that's gonna dominate a whole lot of the time and conversation. We're gonna talk. I mean, we did the St. Louis Police Force, state takeover last year, so Kehoe got that done and got a win on that. So, I mean, I'm sure we'll still talk about how can we be tough on crime and how can we keep communities safe and how can we foster economic development. And I assume that's where the, cutting taxes comes into play. But, honestly, Sarah, I don't hear a lot of people complain about the 4 and 4/10% of income tax that you pay in Missouri. I generally hear people talk about how much money they send to the feds. But I mean, I guess, I mean, there's a world where some of those issues, we can maybe try to find some common ground on. I mean, I think people want our communities to grow. Education options are going to be talked about, I'm sure, again. We saw the state treasurer come out and say, thanks for the $50 million in general revenue and the Most Scholars program, but it really needs to be $100 million. The interesting thing to me is I don't know how we're going to add another $50 million to that program when we're cutting $1 billion elsewhere. So that'll be interesting, excuse me, to sort through. But I'm hopeful that there's some things that we can all work together on, because that's what makes us better.
Moving to something that is probably not going to have bipartisan support, something that Governor Kehoe wants to pass is a plan to eliminate the state income tax. How do you think that's going to be received, especially since there will likely have to be tax increases to make up for lost
Well,
revenue?
you got, yeah, I mean, Sarah, you're exactly right. You've got to offset it. And that's why, I mean, the precursor to this I gave earlier, individual income tax in the state brings in $9 billion a year. Makes up 2/3 of our general revenue budget. I mean, the very simple rough math on state sales tax, each percent of state sales tax without any further exemptions brings in about $1 billion. Okay. So if we have to offset $9 billion from individual income tax, and I'm sure, like, I haven't talked to the administration about what their plan is. They haven't unrolled anything that I know of yet with specifics. But if we're talking about, offsetting that income tax with a sales tax, you're talking about adding 9 or 10% to the state sales tax. And then what I would want, people like you guys to do is, and I've pulled a few of these numbers, but you're going to have taxing jurisdictions in this state that have 20 plus, 22, 24 percent sales tax rates. Can you imagine? And I'll use let's use a you know let, let's use a car as an example, or a truck. Go buy an F-150, and say you get the nice tricked out one that's got the cool wheels on it and electronic running boards that get ripped off occasionally and things like that. That truck's maybe that truck might cost $100,000, and you finance it for 72 months or 84 months or however long these people you do this now. And you have a sales tax bill on that purchase for $25,000. Do you think the auto dealers of Missouri are going to be okay with that? I don't think so. I don't think you can shift that burden. And then there's a conversation, Sarah, about, well, maybe we'll start taxing services. You know what happens when a service industry is handed an additional burden on them? They pass it on to everyone who's taking advantage of the service, right? So then the price of the service goes up. So it's the devil's in the details on all this stuff. And again, you're talking to the guy who worked with Governor Parson the last time we cut $1 billion in income tax, but we did it, in my opinion, in a responsible way. And me and the governor at the time butted heads about how we should do that, but we did it in a way that, as general revenue grew at a certain percentage, a tenth of a percent of income tax would roll off the books. Now, that takes, I mean, that may take, under even a perfect world, that may take 10 years to get half a percent of income tax rolled off, but you're not tying your hands behind your back while you're doing it. Now, again, I've always said, budgets are about priorities. And oftentimes people say, I don't know why we keep talking about cutting taxes when you don't have the money to provide the services that we want to provide for folks anyway. And that's, I mean, oftentimes a valid concern. I mean, our teachers, even though we've made investments in them, are still some of the lowest paid in the country, starting teachers. I mean, our state workers are kind of in the same boat. Again, give Governor Parson a whole lot of credit. He made a priority over his entire tenure of being governor of investing in those state employees, and I think they appreciate it. But at the same time, I mean, there's still, I mean, you gotta have living wage jobs to make it work in this world.
So I tend to think, and sometimes it's not correct, but I tend to think that interim committees that are created between sessions can kind of show priorities in the upcoming session. And in this case, the Speaker of the House created a committee on property taxes, looking at property taxes. So I guess my first question is, and there's always a call for reducing personal property taxes. So a different tax buckets. What do you think about possible legislation on
Yeah.
those in the upcoming
So
year?
that's a really fun one, Sarah, because you know what? Like property taxes and personal, like real property and individual property taxes, you know what they don't really affect? The state. They affect your locals, right? So I had a meeting with the new the DESE, Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, state board last night. They're down here in Springfield. They've got meetings this morning, which actually I told them, I said I had to do this podcast or I would totally have gone to their meeting all day today, but since I'm doing this, sorry, I can't do it. So thanks for that, for getting me out of that probably half day with them. But point is, I actually asked because one of the new board members from kind of around the Kansas City area used to be on one of his local school board. And I said, hey Mike, and this we had dinner last night. I said, hey Mike, what would your finances look like in your school district if the state got rid of property tax? And he said, well, I don't know how that is possible. And I said, well, I mean, I said, it's a real conversation and it's a growing conversation. And I'm just curious what you would do. And he's like, I mean, he flat said, he said, well, I can't tell you how we've, it makes up 60, Sarah, 65% of that district's budget is made up by property taxes. So again, like that money, I mean, that money has to come from somewhere.
Another interim, or kind of, it's an interesting committee on the House, and it is called the House Future Caucus, and it's kind of dealing with issues that they kind of see coming to Missouri and issues to face. They had a hearing over the summer about disaster relief and disaster preparation. It could delve into issues maybe AI. I guess kind of what do
But we
you
don't have to delve, Sarah, we don't have to do anything with AI, right? Because didn't the president yesterday say that he's going to take care of all that and the states don't need to worry about it?
Yeah, I did hear that. And
So
also,
like,
if that.
hey, like, I mean, I hate to jump in too much, but like, I mean, I guess if the president says we don't have to worry about it, he's going to take care of it. Like, just get in line. Let's watch the show.
Yeah, just to chime in here. How do you think that people are going to react when if that executive order goes through, which I doubt it will, that AI regulation and also includes data centers, and that would allow for a giant data center to be just put next to a residential development with no oversight. I feel like people are going to be really pissed about that when they figure that out.
Kind of like the cattlemen and beef producers were whenever we started saying, or not we, but when the president started saying he was going to quadruple the imports of Argentinian beef into this country, kind of like that, kind of like we were mad about that. Yeah, I mean, like, but there's no accountability, right? I mean, that's what I always tell people, like, oh, well, I don't like this or I don't like that. I said, well, then you're going to have to work on changing it. Like that's, I mean, the absolute root of this entire political structure in this country. And again, like I'm trying not to be melodramatic here, but you've got to be able to be willing to stand up for what you think is right and stand against what you think is wrong. And when people don't do that, the folks, quote unquote, in charge just run roughshod over everything. So, I mean, the idea that, all of a sudden, we need to have national policy on AI. I mean, no offense to, our good friends in Congress, but I don't see a whole lot of, I don't see a whole lot of good coming out of DC every day.
All right, I'm going to make the last section a lightning round, and it's all
Love it.
about election-related stuff. So you are allowed to answer in a sentence or two or more, or you are literally struck by lightning because I have the power
Got
to
it.
summon the elements.
Got it.
So Missourians will end up voting on a proposal to require any constitutional amendment placed on the ballot through the initiative petition process to win approval in 8 out of 8 congressional districts. You also voted against this. How do you think this will fare at the ballot box?
Fails.
Some Republicans I talked to are confident it will pass because it includes a bunch of uncontroversial items, such as banning foreign donations to
You
ballot
mean
items.
ballot candy? Call it ballot
Yes, I
candy,
was going to call
Jason.
it ballot candy. Do you
Okay.
think the ballot candy on that is sweet enough for people? And in
Nope.
a sentence or two, you just don't think it is? Okay.
Nope.
Do you think that Republicans have overused ballot candy, even if they say, well, Clean Missouri did it first and we're just responding to it?
Yeah, my response to that is two wrongs don't make a right. It's the same thing as redistricting. I won't give you a long answer, but when people say, well, California did this or Illinois did this, I say, I don't know. I've got two boys and I'm trying to raise responsible kids. And if one of them slaps somebody else, I don't say, go back and slap the other one. I say, figure out a different way to handle this. Two wrongs don't make a right.
Speaking of ballot candy, how do you think an effort to undo the 2024 Abortion Rights Amendment will fare at the ballot box, especially after the appeals court rewrote the summary to be more favorable to abortion rights proponents?
I think that passes.
You think that the, what do you mean it passes? You think it pa you think that voters will repeal Amendment
Yes.
3 from,
Yes.
okay, why?
Because we're pro-life, man. I think that like supersedes everything.
But voters voted to legalize abortion a year ago.
I know.
So, okay. Do you
That one may
think?
be a toss-up. I don't
I want to ask about your Senate district, which is
know.
going to be the most hotly contested state legislative race in the state. At this point, you have Democratic State Representative Betsy Fogel, who will likely be running against Republican Melanie Stinnett, although I also hear there could be a Republican primary there too. Is this the year that Democrats finally take over the Springfield-based district, especially if it's a bad night for Republicans
I
nationwide?
mean, if you look at, was it Virginia that flipped like 30 congressional seats, a couple of weeks ago? I mean, like, I think the president's approval rating, whether he, agrees with the numbers or not, is not helpful to the Republicans right now. And people got to remember in Springfield, I mean, it is a toss-up district. It's a 51-52% Republican district. This isn't a cakewalk for either of them. And I've told both of them, the only caveat to what you're asking right now is if the president decides to run for a third term, I'm running for a third term in the Missouri Senate.
You really want to subject yourself to that
Absolutely not. No,
torture?
I am so happy. No. I'm, I've never been a proponent of term limits until about the last 6 months.
Will you ever run for anything again?
I don't know. I mean, I don't, I get asked that every day, everywhere I go, and I don't know. I don't
What
know.
about running? Yeah, what about running against your extremely good friend Eric Burleson in the 7th district?
Eric is a good friend. He has got his, nose under the, curtains at the Smithsonian looking for skeletons of angels right now, and oftentimes waiting on the mothership to return. I think Eric's a good guy. I would like to see the priorities of my 7th district congressman be a little more in line with the 10 counties that he's got down here, but we'll see.
I didn't hear a no there. And also, I mean, let's just be honest. You said there's no secrets. I actually don't think you two like each other very much. Is that true?
I don't dislike him, and here's the thing. So, like, and it's a big a quick story, but like, I've spent my entire time in Jeff City on the budget and appropriations world, right? And so Eric used to, and again, like, whatever, like, Eric used to vote against all the budget bills in the Senate when he was in the Senate, and maybe he voted for a couple of them here and there. So don't quote me on saying he's never voted for an appropriations bill, but I remember 1 year, and like, we put, like, I mean, Jason, we put hundreds of hours into this thing, right? Like, we
Yeah.
like. Senator Hageman and I and the whole committee, there's, at the time there was 13 of us, now there was 14, whatever. Like, it's a huge committee. We put in a ton of work. And And you roll these things out to the floor and you stand till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. You answer everybody's question. I mean, I was answering questions the first year I was chairman for Mike Moon till 2:33 in the morning. Okay. Like open book. You got a question, we're gonna work through it, we're gonna talk about it, whatever. I mean, open door, any senator. I mean, I would grab, you know, Rick Bratton one year in the basement garage and say, "Hey, Rick, if you've got like a list of stuff that you're trying to do for Cass County that I can be helpful on, like come by the office, let's talk about it." Never took me up on that, but like whatever. So my point with Eric is Eric voted, you know, generally just votes against all the appropriations bill. And one year it just Jason, it just like hit me wrong. And I went over to him after we got done and I said, "Look, dude, like what gives? Like what? Like how can you not find anything in this that you can support?" And his response to me, like I swear to you, was, "The numbers are too big." Well, we're
There you
running a
go.
state, Congressman, now we're running a state, and I'll bet the numbers in DC are even bigger. You know, like my curiosity is like, do we get all these very conservative members of Congress to vote for the next big ag bailout? That the first number that USDA threw out was about $10 billion, and I think they quickly doubled it because we had like, I mean, talk to Jason Bean over in the boot heel, but I mean, our soybean guys took it on the chin for the third and first part of the fourth quarter of this year with, you know, China not importing one soybean whatsoever to the tune of about $1.5 billion in lost revenue. So then all of a sudden, then you got these conservative members of Congress that are, I guess, forced to vote for a big ag bailout to keep these farmers in business.
Yeah,
So we'll see.
that I admit I egged you on, and that was longer than a couple sentences, but you can blame me for that
It's all
because
right.
I wanted to
It's all right.
cause some trouble there. But thank you, Senator. This has been a great conversation, and we really appreciate your time and your
Anytime, Jason.
candor. For all of our stories, go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And Senator, how can people find you on social media where you want to be found?
You just got to find me on, I guess, what's called X now. I mean, I've got a Facebook page, but the campaign people run it. I don't even know how to get into it, which is probably a good thing. So check me out on X.
Thank you very much, and until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.